Hello and welcome to Inside Europe, the weekly current affairs podcast and radio programme from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. I'm Kate Laycock in Bonn. This week on the show, demonstrators take to the streets as France gets another prime minister. And waiting in the wings, we take a closer look at the national rally's bid for respectability and why a certain Donald J. Trump might be proving a problematic ally. Plus, wicked problems. I'll be speaking to Danish political scientist Sigurd Winther Nielsen about his plan to fix democracy's back door. That's all coming up here on Inside Europe. They say a week is a long time in politics, but in France at the moment, that does not even begin to cover it. On Monday, the government collapsed. On Tuesday, the president named a new prime minister. And on Wednesday, an attempted rebellion played itself out on the streets of towns and cities across France. Bloc en tout, block everything, it was called. And the principal demand was President Macron's resignation. Our reporter, John Laurenson, has been following the situation for us in Paris, where he went to one of the places where disruptors had been called to gather.
Despite its origins with largely anonymous agitators on the internet and its stated aim to bring France to a halt through direct action, the Bloc en tout gathering at Place du Châtelet, a square in the middle of Paris, looked for all the world like a typical French demo. Oldish trade unionists and youngish students mainly. Some red flags for the former, some Palestinian ones for the latter. All the people I spoke to here said President Macron was too right-wing, although he is a former socialist minister who now identifies as a centrist. Marc, for example, hasn't forgotten that one of his first acts as president was to scrap the wealth tax.
I'm here because the president, Emmanuel Macron, is the president of France since 8 years. He gives a lot of money to the rich people, the richest people of the France, not the 10%, more like the 0.1%, something like this. And in the same time, the poor of the France are a lot more people and a lot more poor.
Many I spoke to, including this woman, Karine, said President Macron was anti-democratic for his choice of a series of prime ministers from the centre-right, although, says Karine, the last elections were won by the left. She was not at all impressed by the argument that a left-wing prime minister would have even less chance of governing with this hung parliament than a centrist. While I was at this demo, there were calls on the internet to loot the stores at the huge shopping mall at Les Halles, a few hundred metres away. The whole shopping centre was closed down and its underground rail station, Paris's biggest and most central, was shut as well. But generally speaking, although there were 400 or so actions around the country and almost 200,000 people taking part in demos, Block Everything did not block very much. At the central station of Marseille, for example, the police pushed back a group of would-be disruptors who tried to enter it. The same thing happened at Paris's Gare du Nord, where the Eurostar International train terminal is situated. After preventing the Bloc en tout from entering the station, the police set up a line and eventually charged a crowd that was taunting them with a familiar chant of "Everyone hates the police." The police intervened countless times throughout the day, pushing back barricades, putting out dustbin fires, removing demonstrators, often roughly, who were trying to block roads by sitting down on them. Some 200 schools were blocked, but many were kept open by police. In all, over 400 arrests were made. Calls to boycott supermarkets and to stop using credit cards were largely ignored. There were some violent incidents, such as demonstrators who stopped an empty bus on the ring road around the Breton city of Rennes and, after evacuating the driver, set fire to it. Some railway electric cables were sabotaged, but they were quickly replaced. Overall, the trains kept running, the road traffic kept moving. An Amazon distribution centre was blocked for 5 hours, a hypermarket was forced to close, but overall, the wheels of the economy kept turning. Interior Minister Bruno Retailleau said,
"À chaque fois qu'il y a For every attempt to block, every act of violence, our home security forces have one order, and that is to intervene. If you read Wednesday's attempted insurrection as a straightforward confrontation between the bloc en tout and the police, it was the police who won. Retailleau, by the way, is a sure bet to continue in his post in France's next government. The new Prime Minister, Sébastien Lecornu, was sworn in as police clashed with protesters across the country. He kept his speech short.
On va y arriver. Parce qu'au fond, vous venez de le dire, il n'y a pas de chemin impossible.
We can do this, said France's fifth Prime Minister in 2 years. Nothing is impossible. Lecornu is a discreet, self-effacing even, serious public servant. Perhaps because of his thinning hair, he appears older than his 39 years. I was born old, he says. Clearly, public speaking is not his strong point. Diplomacy is. He hails from the centre-right Republicans, but was excluded from the party when he threw in his lot with Emmanuel Macron and joined his first government in 2017. He's still a trusted partner of the president's. Lecornu has been criticised for lunching with the national rally leaders Marine Le Pen and Jordan Bardella on several occasions. But now, with the national rally apparently unwilling to compromise and calling unswervingly for new elections, the new PM is thought to be likely to try to secure a working parliamentary majority stretching from the centre-right and the centrists to, this would be the new thing, the socialists, perhaps even the Greens, but not the far-left France Unbowed, which supported Bloc en Tout. And in this first speech as PM, he promised change not only of form, but of substance.
Monsieur le Premier ministre, cher François, merci.
That substance is likely to be a move to the left and a scaling down of his predecessor's attempt to reduce the debt. He could, for example, meet the socialists halfway by approving some sort of new wealth tax and scrapping François Bayrou's idea of getting rid of two public holidays. It looks possible on paper, but the French political world has become a volatile place and the French people are deeply fed up with Emmanuel Macron and governments made in his image. Lecornu will need all his diplomatic talent to make a go of this. John Lawrenson, DW, Paris.
On the streets this week, it was the left that was channeling the anger and political disillusionment that is now undeniably so widespread in France. Polling, however, shows the far-right National Rally Party in prime position to benefit from this democratic malaise in elections in 2 years' time, or perhaps even sooner, as many in the country are now calling for. So, time to take a closer look at this force in waiting, and in particular, the thing that perhaps most distinguishes it from other far-right parties in Europe, its attitude to US President Donald Trump. Here's Lisa Bryant's report.
On a sweltering afternoon in the French capital, a tour group ducks into the cool opulence of France's Senate building on a visit organized by France's National Rally. For these party supporters, it's a chance to learn a bit of history and get a close-up look at power that has long eluded France's far right, but maybe not for much longer.
I passed the Senate on my way to class.
Noé Marginal studies economics at Pantheon Alsace University in Paris.
It's beautiful
from the outside, and I wanted to see what it looks like on the inside, so I joined this visit organized by the National Rally.
Marginal only recently joined the National Rally. He says it's the party he most identifies with. The group on the Senate tour mirrors the National Rally's increasingly diversified base. Seniors and students like Marginal, blue-collar workers, and white-collar professionals.
Mes amis.
It's a diversity National Rally leader Marine Le Pen has been cultivating since inheriting the party from her father in 2011. She's tried to mainstream its image, reaching out to gay, Jewish, and more center-right voters, even as she's kept the National Rally's populist brand. Her party echoes many of the same messages, including cracking down on immigration and deep skepticism of the European Union, sounded by Europe's other right-wing movements, and by the United States government of President Donald Trump.
Can you hear me okay?
But unlike other European parties, such as the far-right Alternative for Germany, the National Rally is more wary of the Trump administration and its entourage.
On past guilt, and we need to move beyond that.
Overall, they are ideologically relatively aligned with Trump, so they've relatively been, you know, positive about his re-election.
That's Camille Lens, deputy Paris office head of the European Council on Foreign Relations, or ECFR.
But they're much more careful, I would say, than a number of other populist leaders in Europe, in the sense that there's a bit more distance from the relationship with the US than what you have in Germany, for example, or in Italy.
Lens and others say there are multiple reasons behind the National Rally's wariness of Trump, from the party's traditional anti-American views to worry about the domestic fallout of US tariffs. And for France's leading opposition party, one currently topping the polls, it could be toxic getting too close to someone so unpopular here at home. A June ECFR poll showed most French voters saw Trump's policies as harmful for France. Only 18% of National Rally supporters approved of him.
Trump's very erratic policies, the threats of the tariffs, these are things that could potentially actually negatively impact French industry and agri-exporters.
That's Susanna Vey, a program officer for the German Marshall Fund think tank.
Le Pen and Bardella cannot really risk appearing on overly friendly terms with a leader who might harm the interests of their core blue-collar electorate.
There are other reasons for the distance. Unlike other right-wing European figures, Le Pen was not invited to Trump's inauguration. Earlier this year, National Rally president Jordan Bardella clashed with Trump ally Steve Bannon, pulling out of a conservative meeting in Washington after Bannon appeared to make a Nazi salute.
I did that exact same wave at Front National 7 years ago. When I gave a speech to them.
Again, the ECFR's Camille Lens.
That's a good example of the risk of being associated to the image of someone like Trump and the people around Trump, who, from the French perspective, can be quite controversial in a moment when, on the contrary, the RN has been working so much in trying to normalize its image and appearing as a party that is able to govern.
Jean-Jacques Bourdin. But Trump rallied behind Le Pen after she was found guilty of embezzlement this year, denouncing the conviction as a witch hunt. At the Senate visit, National Rally supporters offered mixed feelings about the U.S. president. Student Marginal believes France and Europe are too tied to Washington.
I think it's better we decide more for ourselves and not be dependent on the United States.
Sarah Coutella likes Trump's America First policies.
I'm not American, but at least he's thinking about his country. I want us to defend the French. I want politicians to listen to the French.
But at a recent anti-Trump rally in Paris, protesters expressed fears a National Rally victory in 2027 could follow the same trajectory as Trump's strong and polarizing presidency. It could happen here, says one protester, Clotilde Desjeunes. That's why we're out here fighting. Analyst Lens believes the National Rally will keep its distance from Trump, so it's not affected by his controversial positions, but it will still be reinforced by the overall rise of the far right in Europe. Lisa Bryant, DW, Paris.
And that rise is, as we know, reinforced by plummeting confidence in democratic institutions and the ability of mainstream politics to address ordinary people's problems. So, what to do about it? I'll be talking to a man who thinks that he has some of the answers in just a minute. That's here on Inside Europe.
¶¶
all the people that I have ever interviewed, I think that the Danish political scientist Zygge Winther Nielsen may have one of the best job titles. He is the founder of the Danish think tank, the Institute for Wicked Problems. Now, in political science speak, wicked problems are problems with many interdependent factors making them seem impossible to solve. And if I tell you that Zygge Winther Nielsen's new book is called The Puzzle State, How to Govern Wicked Problems in Western Democracies, then you may begin to see why I was so keen to get him into our Berlin studio on his recent visit to the German capital. Now, I am no puzzle expert, but even I know that you start with a corner piece. So which problem would Zygge Winther Nielsen pick?
So the overall wicked problem for me, that's we are trying to solve some of the most complex big challenges like climate change or international security or big tech on the one hand. And on the other hand, we do it with fast, ill-informed policies, and then we naturally fail.
Okay. So the problem is in the problem solving itself, or at least the structures that we have in Western democracies that you would expect to be solving the problem, so governmental institutions.
In the book I just released, I'm talking about the front door of democracy and the back door of democracy. So the front door of democracy, that's actually what we're doing right now. That's being in the media, discussing back and forth and voting for a party and whatnot. But there's also the back door of democracy. And that's where all the laws, all the ideas from the front door are getting implemented at hospitals or schools or trying to do something with the climate. And we see here that the front door has been open wide with a lot of proposals that are not, manageable at all to be implemented at the back door. And then the back door just slams shut of democracy.
Maybe we could sort of zoom in on a concrete example where the connection between that front and back door isn't working. And you could sort of help me understand how a system that actually managed to connect those two would work.
Lately, I got a son with my wife at the hospital, but it was a terrible experience at the hospital. And so the government said, well, now at the front of democracy, you are entitled to 2 days in bed after you're giving birth to your child. And so they tried to implement that at the back door at hospitals. But really, there was no funding for it. And it was really not the problem. We didn't want to stay two more days at the hospital. We want to go home. But it would be nice if there was something of a really good situation where you can give birth. But that's much more complicated for politicians to do something about because that involves lawyers and nurses and planning and all that. And that's what happens sometimes, that politicians right now are solving the easy ones of the problems and not the root cause of the problem.
And things like this are so important because when people's actual real life experience of interfacing with institutions is in a complete disconnect to political discourse, then they start to feel like they're being taken for a ride. They start to lose faith in democracy. Now, you've studied five countries, USA, Italy, UK, Germany, Denmark. And in terms of people's confidence in the ability of their democratic institutions to deliver for them, the results that you found were really sobering.
Yeah, for sure. Normally when we talk about a crisis in our democracies, we talk about the front door of democracy. Are people voting? Are they confident that the state will do something for them or the police will come and help them? But here I looked at the back door of democracy. So do citizens believe that government can actually make a change at hospitals and schools or in companies? I don't know. To make society prosper. And the results are really remarkable, I have to say, in a pessimistic way. Especially the German case is interesting. For instance, there's one question where people are asked, so do you think society will be better in 10 years from now? And in Germany, 82% say, no, we don't believe society will be better in 10 years from now. That's a really high number. Normally, we will say, well, the next generation will have a better life than our ones. So it's really pessimistic. But I have to say, also in the UK and the United States, Denmark and Italy, the numbers are really high, up there around 75, 77, 79 in UK.
Yeah, those are really sobering results. But if that's the diagnosis, I suppose my question has to be, you know, what's the cure?
In the book, I interview a lot of top politicians, also in Germany and UK, and they say the pace and the number of issues we have to deal with are just so enormous, and that makes it impossible for us to really do good implementation. So why I'm saying all this is that what we need is sort of a feedback loop from reality at the back door onto the front door. So what I suggest is that we set up this feedback loop between the back door and the front door. People at the front line, they can report back, not in a dry survey with 20 questions they have to fill in. No, they can actually just get a text message, and then they can voice record what they experience. They can take a video of themselves, they can take pictures.
But I mean, arguably, wouldn't that just be sort of adding to the noise?
Yeah, you're right. There's so much noise. But the great part about all this is that with AI, you can take all these thousands of ideas that come from the front line, and it will see different patterns between all of these ideas at the back door.
Are you cautious in the light of, I mean, we've had experiences like the post office scandal in the UK and the Netherlands. There was even Mark Rutte had to dissolve his government at one point because of the involvement of an algorithm in identifying supposed benefit fraud, and the algorithm turned out to be biased. But there was this sort of institutional assumption in both cases that, hey, because a machine has been involved, the way in which it has processed the information must have been neutral. Do we experiences like that make you cautious?
Of course. I mean, one of the things we do at this think tank that are doing this work is that we really take it so seriously, doing it responsibly. So we are having close collaboration with some of the best scientists and universities, like Oxford University, for instance. So we really make sure that what you're describing here will not happen.
And this tool, what stage is it at?
So right now we are working with a couple of ministries in Denmark on two big reforms. So one for youth unemployment, there's a big reform in Denmark there, and the other one for elderly care, there's a big reform as well. So right now we are doing these feedback loops from the back door to the front door here, but it's still new. And the reason why I am sitting in Berlin right now is actually because we are talking to, yeah, foundations and civil servants here about actually using this tool to reconnect the front door and back door through these feedback loops.
Sigurd Winter-Nielsen is the author of The Puzzle State, How to Govern Wicked Problems in Western Democracies. He's also the founder of the fantastically named Institute for Wicked Problems. He was talking to me, Kate Laycock, here on Inside Europe. Welcome back to Inside Europe, the weekly current affairs podcast and radio programme from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. I'm Kate Laycock in Bonn.
Does Europe have the stomach to fight? Do we have the unity and the sense of urgency, the political will and the political skill to compromise? Or do we just want to fight between ourselves?
EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen there delivering her annual State of the Union speech to the European Parliament on Wednesday. That same day, Poland's Prime Minister Donald Tusk announced that multiple Russian drones had entered Polish territory and been shot down with the help of NATO allies. This, the Prime Minister said, is the closest Poland has been to open conflict since World War II. Tensions were already running high in the region ahead of joint military drills between Belarus and Russia, set to run from September 12th to 16th. The last time Russia and Belarus held these exercises, called Zapad or West drills, was back in 2022, just days before Moscow sent its troops into Ukraine. Poland, Latvia and Lithuania all share a border with Belarus, and tensions are running high in all three countries. DW's Lisa Louie sent us this report from the Lithuanian border.
From where I'm standing in Lithuania, Belarus is just 15 metres away. But I can't just walk across this 600-kilometre long border. It's equipped with a double fence with barbed wire and surveillance cameras. The Lithuanians want to make sure that no one crosses this line undetected, as the country knows what a Russian invasion would mean. Until 1991, Lithuania was part of the Soviet Union. On this sunny Wednesday afternoon, I'm accompanying two soldiers on a patrol along the stretch of land. They've been receiving extra training over the past few weeks to prepare for potential border transgressions, as Lithuanian authorities are wary. So-called Zapad exercises are nothing new, but the drills running from the 12th to the 16th of September mark the first time the joint Russian-Belarusian exercises will have taken place since the start of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine in 2022.
Reinforcement of border surveillance at the border.
Here's General Rustamas Liubajevas from the Lithuanian Border Control.
Now Russia is much more seriously taken as a possible aggressor. Well, we're preparing for a very broad range of provocations. Those might be use of migrants, aggressive actions at the border against border guards by migrants, when the migrants are being instructed by Belarusian to be very aggressive, to use different tools to attack border guards. Those might be also use of drones.
As has happened during previous drills in the past, thousands of soldiers will test military equipment like tanks, drones and machine guns. But this time, they'll also be trained in the use of Russia's new intermediate-range nuclear-capable ballistic missile Oreshnik. Lithuania, though, is adamant it won't blink first. Vilnius has been increasing its annual defence spending from under 2% of GDP in 2021 to over 5% next year. The country is also organising its own military drills these days, jointly with Estonia, Latvia and Poland. Up to 40,000 soldiers are to take part.
Hello. Hi. Nice to meet you.
And yet, there's concern the Russian-Belarusian military exercises could increase the threat level in the long run, says Linas Kujala, head of Vilnius-based think tank Geopolitics and Security Center.
Russia perceives us as countries, more as territories that should be under Kremlin's direct or indirect control. What we are going to be looking for is certainly whether those troops that are going to be in Belarus or around Belarus are going to be staying there after the exercise, whether Russia is really increasing its presence on the Belarusian soil, including the infrastructure, and possibly preparing for some scenarios in 2, 5, 7, or 10 years.
The fear of an attack has been scaring many here, especially since the start of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, says Margarita Seselgita, the director of the Institute of International Relations and Political Science at Vilnius University.
So it comes with the information, cyber attacks.
According to a 2024 poll, 70% of Lithuanians perceive Russia as a threat.
During the first weeks of Russian war against Ukraine, there were a lot of people who were considering leaving the country. I also heard a number of people thinking that they should take their families out of Lithuania during the actual Zapad exercises, because there was this feeling that, you know, something might happen.
Cecil Gita adds that people just can't help drawing a direct comparison with Russian military build-up on the Ukrainian border in late 2021.
Initially, those troops were moved to the border for the exercise, and then they've been reinforced, and that was the start of the war. So, you know, having in mind these historical examples, sometimes you can jump to conclusions.
Experts think an attack on one of the Baltic states is unlikely with the Ukraine war still ongoing. Russia won't have the resources for two fronts, they say. But the inhabitants of the small Lithuanian village of Gulbina, just a few kilometers away from the border with Belarus, are still on edge. Aida Tarashkevich and her husband Meshislav have lived in one of the village's seven houses for almost two decades. They describe an atmosphere of fear ahead of the drills. Most residents here are against the drills, Meshislav told me. It's really frightening, he added, especially as it's just around the corner. We all fear that this war will soon come to us, his wife Aida agreed. We are afraid, really afraid. With Russia clearly showing an expansionist agenda, these fears are unlikely to dissipate anytime soon. At some point in the future, the Lithuanian border could become the country's first line of defense. Lisa Lui, DW, Lithuania.
After that sobering reminder of the vulnerability of European land borders, we're going to spend the rest of the programme in places with no land borders at all. The islands of Corsica, Lewis and Greenland, respectively. This isn't exactly escapism, however, as the presence of Greenland in that list will probably already have alerted you. Just because you're an island doesn't mean that you're necessarily safe from invasion. The Mediterranean island of Corsica, for example, has been invaded and occupied multiple times throughout history. Indeed, the island's language, Corse, is far more indebted to first Roman and then Italian conquerors than it is to France, the country to which it currently belongs. And Corsica's struggle for self-rule is an ongoing political issue for island and mainland alike. One step forward, some say, is an effort to insert language into France's constitution, recognising the island's autonomous status. But the initiative has dragged on for months, and even in Corsica, it stirs debate. Lisa Bryant reports from the Corsican town of Corte.
Corte's museum offers a virtual tour of the history and culture of Corsica and its proud identity, including the Corsican language, which is similar to Italian, and polyphonic music. On Corte's streets, colorful graffiti captures another spirit of this island, demands by some Corsicans to free nationalist militants and for mainland French to leave. This northern hilltop town has long been the cultural and political heart of Corsica. Dominating the main square is the statue of 18th century independence leader Pascal Paoli. He briefly presided over a quasi-independent state, heading a resistance against Genoese and French rule. Corte was its capital. But Corsica returned to France's orbit under another Corsican, Napoleon Bonaparte.
Au fond, ayons l'audace de bâtir une autonomie à la Corse dans la République.
Corsica has seen a more recent move for greater self-rule. Let's have the audacity, French President Emmanuel Macron said in 2023, to create an autonomous Corsica, but within the French Republic.
Last year, the island's political leaders struck a deal with Paris to insert that autonomy recognition in the constitution. The government wants it adopted by year's end, but it needs legislative approval, and France's conservative Senate supports only a narrow interpretation of autonomy.
The big risk is we'll have a reform that's just symbolic. We've seen similar efforts for other French départements and overseas, and the results are pretty much nil.
André Fazi is a political scientist at the University of Corsica in Corte.
The project that was adopted by French authorities and Corsica's elected officials doesn't satisfy anybody.
Still, Fazi believes any constitutional mention is better than none at all. At Corte's University, students like Julien Preziosi support some kind of autonomy for the island.
I think it's important to fight for the Corsican identity, because otherwise it could disappear.
Pierre-François Brichler, studying Corsican archaeology, isn't interested in politics.
But we're proud of this identity. I think it's important to preserve our values, but the idea of self-management is complicated.
Bonjour à tous. Un attentat sans précédent a été commis hier soir en Corse.
Corsica's independence movement surged in the 1970s with the creation of the National Liberation Front of Corsica. The FLNC, as it's called, and other separatists staged bombings and other attacks against symbols of French governance. Then 1998 saw the shocking assassination of French prefect Claude Erignac. Corsican nationalist Ivan Colonna was accused of killing him.
Et vous et Bruno, vous venez de Bastia d'origine?
Non, de Balagne et de...
Prominent Corsican journalist and author Michel Codazione closely covered that era.
Donc elle a tué cet homme dans le dos alors qu'il est...
To have shot this man in the back when he was out with his wife is incomprehensible. But if these independence fighters assassinated the prefect, it was because there was a kind of deception. They felt there was no other solution.
Explosion de joie pour Gilles Simeoni et Jean-Guy Talamoni.
In 2014, the FLNC formally laid down its arms. A few years later, a nationalist coalition won Corsican territorial elections for the first time. Nationalists still hold power on the island today.
Ça veut dire que la Corse a vécu une révolution tellurique.
Corsica witnessed an earthquake. Going from a Corsica under the thumb of French Jacobinism to a Corsica possibly autonomous within the Republic framework, in peace.
But Codazione counts among Corsicans disappointed in the nationalist record, faulting them for failing to properly manage key issues like garbage, water, and tourism.
Aujourd'hui, on s'occupe de savoir comment.
Today, people are more concerned about who will be on candidates' lists for the next elections, not the next step in programs.
Some Corsicans are moving back to the island from mainland France. French retirees are arriving too, attracted by its natural beauty and potentially diluting Corsica's fierce identity with uncertain consequences. Lisa Bryant, DW, Corte, Corsica.
I once, by the way, walked the length of Corsica from north to south following the famous GR20 route through the mountains, which gives me the right to call myself a GRviste and to tell you with authority that this is genuinely one of the most beautiful places that I have ever been. As it happens, the Scottish Hebrides, or Western Isles, are also very high on my personal places of beauty list. So it's something of a treat for me this week that our next report comes from the island of Lewis. Lewis and the other islands that make up the 200-kilometre-long Outer Hebrides chain are facing a demographic crisis like nowhere else in the UK. More than a quarter of the population is over 65, and it's predicted that that figure will rise to 40% by 2037. So, what's causing this, and can anything be done about it? Sounds to me like a job for the reporter most likely to mix a microphone with wellies and a sou'wester, Richard Baines.
In the island's capital of Stornoway, a group of schoolboys is busking for tourists and talking about the future.
I probably will stay here because, I mean, I love the culture, I love the music, just the people and stuff, and it doesn't seem to have, like, as much culture and tradition just on the mainland.
Generations of my family's been living here, so I just love to stay.
My family's been here the same as him, basically. I wouldn't want to be the one to leave.
But the chances are that in 10 years' time, they'll not be staying here in the Western Isles, with half of the island's young people leaving for work or study. And that's not the only factor driving the average age up. To get here is an hours-long ferry journey, starting at one of the small ports scattered along Scotland's remote western seaboard. But these wild scraps of land, battered by the North Atlantic, have a haunting beauty. This stretch of golden sand and turquoise sea is one of dozens on the Isle of Lewis alone. And this dramatic scenery is pulling in a new wave of inward migration.
The problem we have is the older people retiring up to the islands.
Debbie Boskert is a senior manager with the local arm of the National Health Service and crunches numbers for them.
We've got dropping birth rates and we have more outward migration than we have inward. And the inward migration tends to be of the middle-aged or the older. All in all, it brings a perfect storm.
For the health service, this means a double whammy, with greater demands on medical resources from a growing older population and a smaller proportion of people available to care for them.
You haven't actually got the population to work, especially for, I would say, the semi-skilled jobs and the unskilled jobs, which can range from domestics to healthcare assistants, to social care workers in care homes, etc. You wouldn't necessarily get anybody coming up from the south, spending £10,000 to £12,000 to move up here to take what is a lower paid job. So the workforce age population that's dropping dramatically. And now we're up against the tourist industry, the fish farms, the supermarkets, the bars.
Debbie's now approaching retirement age herself.
I am worried because my family's up here, my friends are up here, but unless anything changes, there will be no one to help look after me if I need it. But it is a real, real worry. And the only thing you've got to do is move. And if I move, I move without family, I move without friends. And I put the burden of my care onto some other health board.
To try to remedy things, the local Western Isles Council has set up a repopulation project in the Southerly Islands known as the Uists.
It's not really that there's a lack of jobs, it's more that there's a lack of people to fill the jobs.
Christina Morrison runs the project, which is using government cash to improve internet connections and housing.
Anybody looking to come live here, and just to give them a bit of guidance and support and to kind of make that process a lot easier for them. Especially, it can be quite handy for people who have never lived in that kind of rural community, be able to talk through how the childcare works or where's the best places to find housing and things like that. A lot of the information we get from that, from conversations, also helps us direct with some of the actions as well with the repopulation zone. So if we're seeing really common themes of barriers, then it gives us things to look into to see if there's anything that we can do to kind of alleviate those barriers.
An apprenticeship scheme and island-based degree courses will help young people to stay. The initiative sells the Uist lifestyle on a website featuring island success stories alongside updates on job and housing opportunities. A scheme called Trial the Isles will provide temporary housing so people can try island life and decide if it's for them before committing. So far, 44 families have settled here after being helped by the scheme. Some are former emigrants returning. So who are the younger people coming to the Outer Hebrides and why do they do it?
Up at this top patch here, we've got a small cloche, so like a little tunnel. And under here we go courgettes.
John Hamilton came here from Gloucestershire 7 years ago.
On this allotment here, we've got broad beans.
He now works a traditional small farm known as a croft on a windswept hilltop on the isolated Rhanish Peninsula.
Being self-employed, and I have total control and flexibility over my lifestyle. My work is flexible, so I can just manage my time how I want to manage my time. So, you know, I dedicate more of my time to my lifestyle choice rather than having a 9-till-5 job. So I would say living on the island gives you more flexibility to do that, you know.
So this is us just coming into the distillery now, where we've got five washbacks. So they're wooden fermenters, which I can open up.
Johnny Ingledew and his partner Kate grew up on the Uists, and like so many, they left the islands after school. But they're now back, and they've started a family and employ 14 people at their new distillery.
Uist isn't remote to us, everything else is remote to Uist, not the other way around. It's a lovely place to live, to raise a family, so we've got a young family now, and community's amazing here, and the environment, the scenery is all amazing. Ultimately, I think we feel quite at home and at peace living out somewhere slightly more wild, essentially.
The council is now looking to expand the repopulation scheme to the whole island chain.
It's been an extremely positive move for us. So, no, this is us for life. I hope and expect our kids will continue to live in the islands. But, you know, who knows? We left the island and I expect they'll leave the island for a period of time as well.
Richard Baines, 4DW, in the Outer Hebrides.
Just one more island to go now, and it's a big one, the biggest, in fact. Greenland is coming up just after the break. Greenland's capital Nuuk has a gleaming new airport. It's part of the Arctic Islands' attempt to attract more tourists. After all, if Greenland succeeds in achieving independence from Denmark, then it's going to need to shore up its economy. But what's drawing tourists to Greenland right now? Well, as Carolyn Beeler reported for The World recently, it's not just the scenery.
The local time is approximately 7:11.
A new direct flight twice a week from Newark started flying this summer, and it's why Carolyn von Kutzleben is visiting Greenland at all.
It's been in the planning since the spring, when United Airlines said they were opening up a nonstop flight to Newark.
Another thing that's attracting more tourists.
What got my interest is when President Trump was elected, he was talking about Greenland a lot, about buying it or taking it over.
Once the Arctic destination was on Leslie Schreiber's radar,
I started doing a little research and it seems very interesting, almost like a last frontier.
Greenland is three times the size of Texas, full of wildlife and pristine fjords dotted with icebergs that will fill just about anyone with awe. It is also home to roughly 57,000 people, which means the influx of visitors is noticeable.
The tourism has been crazy.
Malia Skifta is behind the coffee bar at Cafe Lolo, on one of the two main tourist drags in Nuuk's compact and often rather gray downtown.
They kind of like take over the town. You can see them everywhere. So like the main airline, the Greenlandic airline, offers food tickets. And we've like, our register is filled with them. You can feel when a flight delays and people come in to eat.
A few blocks away is a glass shop popular with locals and tourists alike. Duet Design sells bowls cleverly created to look like breaking sea ice and colorful coasters with far north designs. Cruise passengers here in their matching parkas are loving it. At her work table in the back, artist and owner Dorit Olsen is busy making a new piece.
So how has business been this summer?
Crazy. Yeah, crazy. We're used to the cruise ships. But because of the new airport, we have had a lot of customers.
You gave a long sigh before you said it's been crazy. Has this been good for you, bad for you, little of both?
Yeah, it's good for business.
She guesses sales are up about 30% over last summer.
But because I only have two hands, like most people do, and 24 hours, then it's hard. It's hard work, yeah.
Having only two hands is not the only concern around here. I meet Esther Kerr when she's out for a walk one evening with her boyfriend.
We are having a lot of trouble with
places that people could stay. Even people born here even have trouble to have homes. And we think a lot of tourists are here, but there's already not enough space.
So you know people that have had trouble finding apartments?
We have. We live in a student apartment right now because we don't have anywhere else to be.
About two-thirds of Greenland's nearly 150,000 tourists last year were cruise passengers. With a new airport built this year and two more scheduled by 2026, more flight passengers are expected. They bring more money into the territory, but also they need somewhere to sleep.
We don't have enough space. Right now we don't.
This is Corinne Peterson-Helling.
I'm the front office manager here at Hotel Hans Egil.
The five-floor hotel, she tells me, has 156 rooms, 14 apartments, all booked for that night.
We had a situation in early July where all flights were canceled. And I had to get a little creative, and I found conference rooms, and I had to put extra beds.
Still, much better than the ski lift cafeteria or the airport lounge. That is where other people have been put up when overflow rooms have been needed at least eight times so far this summer. One problem has been the weather. It is notoriously bad in Nuuk and a reason critics argued an international airport should never have been built here. The day I was supposed to fly in, high winds shut the airport down for a full day. When my flight out of Nuuk was also canceled.
Yes, hello, this is Jacob.
Hi, Mr. Sorensen. Thank you so much for your time. My name is.
I called up Jacob Nitter Sorensen to ask what was going on. He's the CEO of Air Greenland, which flies the most in and out of Nuuk.
I think we've seen weather disruptions in 2025 that have by far exceeded anything that we've seen before in terms of storms, in terms of fog.
But the number one driver of flight delays and cancellations this year, he said, problems at the new airport in Nuuk.
It is basically a shortage of staff. The new airport, with all the traffic that's coming in this year, the need for trained and screened security staff is quite high. And the fix for that is, well, get more staff.
Which Sorensen says the airport is working on. The operator of the airport hasn't returned a request for comment from the world. Greenland's tourism board says they're looking at how to create a, quote, smoother experience for tourists and locals alike and sending people beyond Nuuk. Meanwhile, despite the strained infrastructure, most locals I talked to did seem happy to show off their territory to more tourists. They have their concerns. But the strongest message was a variation of what I heard back at Cafe Lolo from the server and barista Malia Skifta.
Do you see this increase in tourism as a good thing, a bad thing?
Definitely, like, mostly a good thing because it's money from the outside. So in order to get to the final goal of being our own land, like not under Denmark, we have to get money from the outside.
A diversified economy, Skifta and others tell me, brings Greenland one step closer to independence, which, according to surveys, most residents want.
You'll find more fascinating stories from Carolyn Beeler and her colleagues at GBH's The World, either by tuning in via public radio if you're in the US or wherever you get your podcasts. Here in the Inside Europe studio, however, we have reached the end of the show. Just time for me to remind you of our feedback address, insideeurope@dw.com. This week's show was produced by me, Kate Laycock, and Laura Kabelka. Our sound engineers were Ziad Abu Sleiman and Naveen Aboot. Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Bonn.